thank you so much for joining us today. This is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse. And as always, we are wishing you the best. And one of the things that's very exciting is we have a new app at Progressive Radio Network. And you can just go to iTunes and put in Progressive Radio Network and get the app so that you can tune us in on your iPhone or as you travel around the country. As I travel around the country lecturing, as I do just about every day, it's very exciting when people come over and say, you know what? I listened to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z on Progressive Radio Network, and that's, of course, at prn.fm, all the time. And what they often tell me is that we actually listen in the car. And it's very amazing to me how you might do that in Ohio or Iowa or California or Florida. But of course, people who are savvy with those things know that you can listen in the car by downloading the shows from Progressive Radio Network, which are very easy to download, onto your device such as your iPod, and then you can somehow, and I don't know how, plug it into your radio and really listen anytime. Now, one of the things that's very important that's going on today is that California voters have actually gotten on their ballot GMO labeling. So they are going to, it's called the Right to Know Initiative Campaign. Very, very important. We need to get this on the ballot in every single state in the country, but it's major that California has been able to do this. The California Secretary of State's office announced that the Right to Know initiative to label genetically engineered food will be on the state's November ballot. So now, even if you're not in California, if you're listening in New York or in any state, we can support our California brethren in getting this passed. It's really major that it got on the ballot. It's a historic initiative, and it would be the first law in the United States requiring labeling of a wide range of genetically engineered foods. Now, if that sounds like it makes sense to you, in other words, what would not make sense about knowing if your food is genetically modified or not? Who do you think would be against you knowing if your food is genetically modified or not? Actually, amazingly enough, I don't think it's too far of a stretch for you to figure out who might be against that. And the people who are against that are Monsanto and the people who create genetically modified food. So even though it makes total sense for everyone to know that their food is genetically modified or not, and then they can choose to eat genetically modified food or choose not to, which, of course, right now we don't have the choice. The difference is that the very, very powerful companies such as Monsanto and other people involved in the agro-business and in the major food corporations do not want the food to be labeled. So they are starting to put together a huge campaign that would be against the genetically modified food. And how they'll do that is that they'll show middle-income people shopping and going, oh, no, now we have to pay so much more for our food because there is a cost to produce the labeling. In other words, the food would have to have a label on it. And it is true. That is going to increase cost to some extent. On the other hand, we're already labeling. So, for instance, if you look at any piece of fruit or vegetable, any consumable in the grocery store, you will notice it has a little tag on it. And if you look carefully, you will see there are numbers on there. So a number 9 indicates that the food is organic, and a number 3 or 4 would indicate that the food is conventional. If it's conventional, you can be sure it is highly sprayed with toxic pesticides. So they are already labeling. So in order to just add perhaps another number that denotes that it is in fact genetically modified would really not be that much of an additional cost. But of course, the powers that be do not want to proceed with labeling, as you might imagine. So we need to be really, really strong at helping our California people perhaps get this law passed. It's so excellent that it is now on the ballot. Now, I do want to tell you that there's a lot of genetically modified food that is on the market right now and that you are probably eating. So I'm going to tell you about some of the foods that are genetically modified, so perhaps you can choose to buy organic and not get genetically modified. So the first one we'll talk about is tomatoes. Now, tomatoes, of course, are a very common food, and you might not know it, but it's the number one symbol of genetically modified food. It's been on the market since 1994. And if you buy any kind of ketchup or canned tomato sauce or soup, all of it contains genetically modified tomatoes, and you may not know it. The most recent converts are talking about a new technique that was developed by researchers for extending the shelf life of tomatoes and other crops, because when you pick a tomato in the field, it usually lasts about 15 days. So what they do is they suppress enzymes that accumulate during the marketing process. So this can decrease waste and increase efficiency, but what does it do to nutrition? And how does it genetically alter the product? And what happens to people who have hidden allergies to some of these things? Another very big crop, which you're probably actually wearing every day, is cotton. Cotton is considered a food oil because its oil can be consumed, but cotton is genetically modified, and it's called BT cotton. It's very common in India and China and has a lot of damaging consequences. According to a recent Chinese research, the BT cotton kills bollworms without the use of insecticides, and that sounds good, but the problem is that it has actually increased the presence of other much stronger crop-harming pests, and also to the development of stronger bollworms, which is one of the things we see all the time with the overuse of antibiotics, for instance. There has been a vast increase in much more dangerous germs that can influence people's health quite negatively. So the BT cotton production has also been linked to a drastic depletion of soil nutrients and lower crop yields. And if you study the news, you will see other additional negative effects are the fact that the BT cotton has initiated a huge rash of suicides in the lands where it is used. So another one is canola oil. This is a really favorite topic of mine, to let people know that canola oil is genetically modified, because so many people think canola oil is a health food. If you go to any even organic food store, you will find, if you read your label, and I suggest you do read your label, that healthy food choices, or supposedly healthy food choices, have a lot of canola oil in them. But the problem is, it is extracted from rapeseed. Canola is actually not a word. There is no such thing as canola. What it means is Canadian oil. So it was developed in Canada. It is bioengineered. It's from rapeseed. And a lot of the toxins have to be chemically removed from the seed. Then they are deodorized and altered in order to be utilized in food. So I would suggest, if you do want to use oil on your food, that you get really good, high-quality organic olive oil. That would be a good choice. Or unrefined organic coconut oil. That would be another good choice. And you can find that in areas that are not genetically modified. Now, another thing to be aware of is artificial sweeteners. Artificial sweeteners are found in a number of products. In fact, almost anything that says sugar-free, if you read the back of the label, you will see that there is a number of artificial sweeteners, such as aspartame, which is also known as NutraSweet. Aspartame was actually discovered by accident in 1965 by a chemist who was testing an anti-ulcer drug. And actually, aspartame has been tracked and found to account for about 75% of adverse reactions to food activities. And this is actually according to the FDA. There's a lot of seizures that have been linked to the use of aspartame as well as other artificial sweeteners. Now, corn. Corn is big. I suggest that all of our listeners watch a movie called King Corn. That's King, K-I-N-G, Corn, K-O-R-N. Sometimes people can't find it easily if they don't look for that. King Corn, K-I-N-G, K-O-R-N. And that movie really demonstrates in such a clear way to follow the fact that corn is in everything. It is one of the most ubiquitous components. And I will tell you, in labeling, corn does not have to be included on the label because it's not considered a recognized allergen, which is really absurd. Soy is, by the way. You might start seeing soy on a lot of labels because soy is a recognized allergen. But corn is now modified to create its own insecticide, and as many as half of all U.S. farms grow corn for Monsanto, and they're using genetically modified corn, with tons of it being introduced to human consumption, according to the FDA. However, it has been recently found that the BT toxin for modified corn is in the blood of pregnant women and their babies, as well as non-pregnant women. They just happen to test pregnant women. What will this modified BT-containing corn do in the long run? Truthfully, it has not been on the market long enough to know. If you would like to be one of those who are part of that great experiment, then go ahead and eat it. But this is why it is so important to get involved. I would say there's many websites you can go to learn more about the initiative on the California voters to deciding on GMO labeling. One of the best ones that I like very much is called organicconsumers.org. That's organicconsumers.org. And you can find out more. You can sign up for their free mailing list and find out how you can help California voters to decide on GMO labeling, and then let's jump on the bandwagon, no matter what state you're in, and get the United States to have choice in eating GMO foods. Very, very important. So we're going to just take a short break here and listen to a natural medicine chest made by myself and Dr. Eugene Zamperone. You can always like us at Facebook, The Natural Nurse, or go to naturalnurse.com under schedule and see where we're giving lectures and classes. You can see our books. And then we'll be right back with our guest today, Sarah Channa, an internationally board-certified birthing instructor and homeopath. We'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the essential oil taken from the Australian tea tree.
The tea tree, known as Melaleuca alternifolia, grows in only one region of the world, the northeast corner of Australia. It is a full-sized tree of the myrtle family, whose oil has powerful abilities to clean and help heal wounds and skin ailments such as cuts, burns, and rashes. In 1770, the infamous Captain Cook was a lieutenant in the British Royal Navy when his ship landed in Australia. The botanist on board, Sir Joseph Banks, collected samples of a sticky aromatic leaf and brought them back to England for further investigation.
In 1923, an Australian curator and chemist, Dr. Penfold, conducted a study on tea tree leaves and discovered that their essential oils are 13 times stronger as an antiseptic bactericide than carbolic acid, considered the standard in the early 1900s. The oil contains 50 to 60% terpenes, 6 to 8% cineol, which causes its camphor-like odor, and several kinds of alcohols. In 1933, the Australian Journal of Pharmacy, the American Journal of the National Medical Association, and the British Medical Journal reported that tea tree oil is a powerful disinfectant, non-poisonous, non-irritating, and has been used successfully in a very wide range of septic conditions. Australian tea tree oil is mentioned in the British Pharmaceutical Codex of 1949, the UK Medicine List, and the Dispensary of the United States.
During World War II, tea tree oil was considered a standard issue item for all first aid kits for Army and Navy units in tropical regions. The demand for tea tree oil exceeded the supply. However, after World War II, synthetic drugs gained in popularity and the use of tea tree oil in medicine waned. In more recent times, a renewed interest in natural, non-toxic alternatives has triggered a resurgence in tea tree oil research. In 1985, Dr. Paul Belacher, chief of the phytotherapy department at the Faculty of Medicine, University of Paris, worked on several double-blind studies involving tea tree oil and its application as a remedy for candidiasis, chronic cystitis, staph and strep infections, and nail bed fungus. He stated, and we quote, "The essential oil of Melaleuca has entered the team of major essential oils and emerges as an antiseptic and antifungal weapon of the first order in phytoaromatherapy."
Try a few drops of tea tree oil in a steam vaporizer and inhale for blocked sinuses, or rub the oil on chest and back for a cough. The Australian Journal of Dentistry reported that using tea tree oil in dental hygiene and in surgery showed it to be an extremely effective antiseptic. Add a drop on your toothbrush or include it as a gargle and mouthwash. Tea tree oil can be applied directly to the skin. Although it's possible that some people may experience a mild allergic reaction, in-depth research has shown tea tree oil to be non-irritating and safe.
So, listeners, think about including tea tree oil, the first aid kit in a bottle, in your natural medicine chest.
And thank you for joining us right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we want to remind you that Progressive Radio Network is continuing to move forward. It's a very exciting time here. And there's a couple of things I'd like you to know about how you can get even more on board with Progressive Radio Network. One thing you can do is jot down this number, because this is a phone number that people can listen to any show here 24/7 while it airs. So that number is 832-280-0066. That's 832-280-0066, and I'm going to be posting that also at naturalnurse.com, and you can also find it at progressiveradionetwork.fm or prn.fm. The other exciting thing that's available is the new app, and you can find that by going to just typing in Progressive Radio Network at the iTunes store. So a lot of people are taking advantage of this, so we are so happy to have you on board right here at The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And I would like to introduce my guest, Sarah Chana. Sarah is an international board-certified lactation consultant, birthing instructor, classical homeopath, and registered herbalist. Sarah guides women from adolescence through pregnancy and childbirth and on to menopause. And she is a mother of seven herself, so she certainly has an awful lot of hands-on experience with this. So, Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
Thank you. Pleasure meeting you.
Now, I see you're a member of the American Herbalist Guild, and I'm actually one of the founding members of that and a professional member of the American Herbalist Guild, and I'm so happy to see that you are a member, because I think it's the premier association in the United States that supports education. We actually have a Long Island chapter, and we're having a meeting of our Long Island chapter on July 12th. So if anybody out there is interested in more, you can get in touch. What made you join the American Herbalist Guild, Sarah?
Well, I thought it was very important to be part of the professional membership. They provide wonderful classes. It's a great way to network with other herbalists. Very often you can get challenging cases. And although I've had a lot of education, it's always nice to hear another person's opinion if I feel like I'm stumped with a client. So I felt that networking was very important. And I know that the herbalists that are part of the organization are really, as you said, the premier herbalists that really take education and research very seriously.
Yes, and it's a great organization to join, even if you're just interested, like we say at our meetings, in all things herbal.
Right.
Now, I was very interested in your personal history and what led you to investigate the world of natural healing.
Well, when I was in university, I suffered from seasonal allergies, and I was raised on, you know, a lot of antihistamines, a lot of foods that were not appropriate for an allergic little girl. And when I went to university, I spent a lot of time reading books about herbal solutions, and I tinkered with it a lot and found it very fascinating. Went to different lectures and tried very hard to educate myself. And my allergies, really, when I began using herbals, my allergies became more under control. When I was pregnant, when I gave birth to my second child had terrible asthma and terrible eczema. He was a very sick young man. And I was trying to be the good mom, and I did all the antibiotics and all the steroids and all the antihistamines, and I found he wasn't really getting better. And so that herbal person inside of me went back and said, wow, I really have to investigate this. So I stood up night after night after night, reading actually every homeopathic book I could lay my hands on, every herbal book I get lay my hands on. I read for hours and hours and hours and hours, and I ended up treating my son naturally, and his eczema got at least 90% better, and his asthma we were able to control. During that time, I was also a lactation consultant in helping women with breastfeeding problems. And I was trained with antibiotics, anti-inflammatories. I was trained as a Western practitioner. And I knew that just as I saw my son progress so beautifully, I knew that if I could learn how to treat breast infections naturally without antibiotics, that I would be helping my clients. Because whenever you use an antibiotic in your breastfeeding, you'll get a secondary ductile yeast infection. And sometimes the ductile yeast infection can actually be even more painful than the breast infection. So they would take an antibiotic for, you know, their 5 to 10 day course, feel better, and 3 days later they'd have ductile yeast. So I knew that if I was going to start treating my my clients, I really needed to go back to school. So I did a 5-year classical herbal, I did a 5-year classical homeopathic program, did about 500 clinical hours, and I loved helping my clients with homeopathy. But I realized that what I really wanted to do was teach my clients how they could treat themselves. Because with classical homeopathy, you really need a homeopath to come up with a homeopathic remedy. Whereas with herbals, you can teach women how to use them, when to use them. And I felt that I would empower my clients more to be able to treat things that would come up. So I learned how to do that, and I did 2 years of herbal training plus, you know, hundreds and hundreds of hours of clinical apprenticeship. And then what happened was when I would have these cute little newborn babies, I would always tell the moms, listen, if your child gets an ear infection, let's go ahead. Let me tell you, you know, go to the doctor, get a diagnosis, know what it is, but let me offer some suggestions in treating ear infections. And it turned out that my clients were really happy to have the tools to be able to treat their children without antibiotics. I mean, we're not anti-antibiotics in my office. I mean, they have a place. They've saved a lot of lives, but for things like runny noses, seasonal allergies, ear infections, even chronic tonsil problems, my clients are really ecstatic to be able to learn how to treat them themselves, and they feel more confident as moms.
That's so true, but I would say that definitely your discussion of classical homeopathics, you know, that's quite complicated, and as you said, takes a lot of time, and we use a various repertories to decide. But there's a lot of what we call now more modern homeocord remedies, which are really focused on getting results with a first aid type issue. And I find there's no problem with actually using them together with herbal remedies.
Yes.
One of the things with children, let's say you try to give a young child golden seal.
Yeah.
And it's
not
so
bitter.
Not going
to be too successful. Correct.
Well, homeopathic, since it's usually either in a water solution or a sweet little sugar pellet,
right.
Kids are usually fine with taking that. So it's
right.
great that you're giving your clients and people who come to see you. Isn't it satisfying to get results and see people get better?
Well, you know, as a classical homeopath, I do see a lot of kids with chronic problems that resolve with homeopathy and herbs, and that's really exciting. I deal with a lot of children that have gone from pediatrician to pediatrician and surgeon to surgeon, and they've kind of, you know, been in the same vicious cycle. And that's really exciting to see children, because all of a sudden the dark circles under their eyes start to resolve. You know, that chronic kind of green, drippy, thick nose resolves. So that's really exciting. I really like when my clients, like you said, with homeopathy, use it for acute situations. You know, their child falls and bumps their head and they've got this big, huge bruise, and they use some arnica internally and some arnica oil, and the child feels better. So, you know, there's two ways that we do it. One, I empower my clients, the moms and dads, to treat their own children for minor things. And then when the children get into more kind of chronic problems, they do come to me, and then I guide them on how to stop the patterning. Because don't forget, when a child is wheezing, for example, the body is wheezing feeling that that is the healthy way to treat that condition, meaning they're reading the dust mite as a serious threat. So they have this inflammatory response, and they get a kind of, you know, inflammation going on. So the child's body feels that the asthmatic response is the healthiest response. So we have to tweak that body and explain that they need to not hyper respond to those dust mites.
It's just wonderful, and I do want to tell our listeners they can find you at your website, which is your name, Sarah, S-A-R-A, Chana, C-H-A-N-A, .com, and there's no www. It's just the http://. And now you are busy, so I imagine there's a lot of interest in what you're doing when you're working with your clients.
Yes, I'm a very busy practitioner. I think one of the benefits was that I started out with as a lactation consultant, and women would come in with cracked nipples and breast infections and bleeding breasts and babies that were colicky and screaming. And I think that since they saw the success with breastfeeding, they were a little more willing and a little bit more gutsy to go ahead and try alternative medicine with their children, because they saw how successful their newborns resolved with their problems. So I was really lucky because I've worked with over 5,000 breastfeeding babies, and then I ended up working with their cousins and their aunts and their sisters and their sister-in-laws, and it was kind of a really positive domino effect of having a lot of people coming in and wanting to learn how to treat themselves naturally. Like when I get a woman with a breast infection, and we use a potato poultice mixed with a little bit of slippery elm bark powder, I mean, these breast infections resolve, as long as, you know, we're resolving the underlying problem of why the woman's getting a breast infection. Because breast infections in a breastfeeding mom is an abnormal behavior. A lot of women say, oh, if I'm going to breastfeed, a cracked nipple, a breast infection, that's normal. That's what you have to go through. That's kind of, you know, what gives you your, you know, your badge of courage. And the truth is that it means that something needs to be fixed. So when they sit there with a potato poultice with some slippery elm bark mixed into it, and they put that in a little gauze pad up against their breast and they feel better, they're shocked. And what an easy, inexpensive solution that is. You know, it's like,
it
how
is.
Much does a potato cost in a piece of gauze?
And it actually works. That's what's so wonderful.
Yeah.
I know you do lecturing all over the place, so one thing that you've been quoted on some major media about is a topic such as herbal medicine. Is it witchcraft or science?
Right, right.
So that would be something that I'm sure you would point out, that there's so many now scientific studies backing all the information that you're sharing.
Right. I know when I was doing research when I was in homeopathic school that I know that homeopaths really have difficulty giving people placebos. Like if you're dealing with someone that's really suffering from osteoarthritis and you have to give half the group the actual homeopathic remedy and the other half nothing, it's very hard for homeopaths to think like that. I think that's what's stopped a lot of these double-blind studies. Because homeopaths...
Well, also money, don't forget. You know,
the
pharmaceutical industry has a huge amount of money. Now, let's just go back and define, because you and I know the difference between herbal medicine and homeopathics. But some of our listeners, you know, we're kind of using those terms almost interchangeably. Why don't we define what is the difference between herbal medicine and homeopathy?
So herbal medicine is when you first identify the plant out in the field, and you then are going to either dry the plant and use it in tea form. You're going to either take that plant in its fresh form and put it in grain alcohol and make a tincture, or you can put that plant in an oil and make an herbal oil. So you're actually taking the plant and you're making a plant product. When you take homeopathy, you're taking a plant mineral poison or other elements, and you are diluting it and succussing it, which is shaking it, which is taking the energy out of the plant mineral or poison. So it's a different, you know, I it's very hard to explain, obviously, but homeopathy works on the energy level of the person. And I believe that the plant medicine goes in and works on the cell structures and the DNA and actually the tissue. So that's how I describe the difference. You may describe it differently, but I know that modern science does not understand energy medicine very well. And even though I'm a practicing homeopath, very successful with many clients, I can say very honestly that I don't quite understand energy very well either. But I know that when you walk into a room, you either like a person or you don't. You walk into a restaurant, you like the ambiance or you don't. Even walking into a supermarket, you can say, oh my gosh, I'd rather shop at the market down the street. It's just got a bad energy. So that's what energy is. It's an invisible force that people feel. Now, when we have an illness, let's say a child has an ear infection. So the child starts to get a fever, the eyes start dilating, the heartbeat increases, the body is pulsating with this heat, and the child's got pain in her or his ears. That's going to create a different energy in that child. Now, if we take the plant belladonna, which is a poisonous plant in its pure form, and we gave it to someone, the reaction would be that they would get an increased heartbeat, they would get a fever, they would get hot, they would start to feel aches and pains. So if we take that diluted version of that belladonna and we give it to that child, the two energies will kind of collide and dissipate, and that's how homeopathy works.
And boy, that's a great one to know about, because when my son, who is now 37 years old, woke up with a hot fever at 4 a.m., and as a parent, you need to decide what to do. Do you run to an emergency room where you know it's going to be just sort of a scene from hell, you know? You're going to be there with all these other sick people, and let's say it's in the winter, and are you going to drag your baby out there? Are you going to sit there and do nothing and you know, be afraid that they may die from such a high fever?
Right.
Or are you going to already have your first aid kit, which has belladonna? You may not remember when to use it, but if you read the book before, you'll know where to look it up. That's why I always tell my patients to be prepared by getting these things in the home, taking classes with Sarachana or taking classes, learn about how to use it, and then you can, I just remember my son when he was a little baby and he had those red shiny cheeks at 4 in the morning, the perfect picture of someone who needs belladonna. And what happened? I gave it to him. His fever actually spiked a little bit, and he broke into a complete and total sweat. And then I just wiped him down with witch hazel, and he fell asleep like a little perfect person, and it was almost completely well in the morning.
And it
just would have been a whole scene to go to a hospital in the middle of the night.
Well, that's what I really try to do with my clients. We, first I take a complete history of my clients and their family. And what I try to do is I'll give them what is called an immune mix, where I'll create an immune mix to the type of illnesses the family tends to get. Now, of course, as a homeopath and an herbalist, we look at each child and each illness as an individual. But we've got, you know, more families. Some have more of a white discharge when they get a cold. Some get more of a yellow discharge. And in my client's house, they have an immune mix, they have a fever mix, and they have a cough mix. So even though we may need to tweak it, meaning they may need to call me the next day and, you know, say, Sarah Khan, I've begun on this kind of an herbal mix, but let me give you the more specific symptoms, they feel empowered to be able to treat themselves and their husbands and their mothers and mother-in-laws when something comes up. And it's great when people travel, because I make it in little 2-ounce bottles, depending on how many people are part of the family. And when they're traveling in the summer, they feel so great. If all of a sudden, even, you know, your husband comes up, oh, my gosh, I'm getting that pre-sinus infection, and you start giving him an immune mix, you know, you can give him 2 to 4 dropperfuls every 2 to 3 hours, then he's going to be much more pleasant on that trip, and that makes everybody happier. So I really try to have my clients have a bunch of different mixtures in their houses that they can use and feel confident using. I mean, in my office, we still go to the doctor. We get a diagnosis. We like to know what's going on, and it also makes people feel more confident if they, you know, let's say they are pre-bronchitis. Okay, they go to the doctor, and the doctor says, oh, I really think you need an antibiotic. You're right on that verge of getting bronchitis. And they go home, and they take their herbs, and they take their homeopathy, and they go and recheck with the doctor a week, week and a half, 2 weeks later, and the doctor says, wow, your chest is clear.
I know, they're always so surprised. What did you do? But we're going to just take a few-minute break right here, Sarah, and when we come back, we will be introducing you once again so people know how to get in touch with you, and we will be continuing our discussion on natural remedies with Sarah Channa, and she's at sarachanna.com. So we will be right back with more right here on Progressive Radio Network. Welcome back once again to more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, hoping that you are staying healthy. And you can visit us anytime online at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse. You can like us at Facebook, The Natural Nurse, and then you'll be up to speed about all the lectures and presentations that we've been doing. Just did one today at Stony Brook Medical School, and even the deans and heads of several of the schools at Stony Brook University joined us on a herb walk right in the parking lot looking at edible and medicinal plants that you can gather. And they were just so amazed. And we are, by the way, running a CEU credit. That's for 5 CEU educational credits, and that's going to be at the University of Bridgeport on October 6th. We do have registration. It's open to professionals and the public, anyone interested in holistic medicine. I will tell you that the tone of the lectures is going to be more on the professional side, but we're inviting consumers to come if they'd like to. I know many of you are extremely educated, and you can also get CEU credits if you are a healthcare professional. So come on board, go to naturalnurse.com, ask me for a sign-up sheet, and we can get that right out to you. Today, we have as our guest Sarah Channa. I'm looking at her lovely website at Sarah, S-A-R-A, Channa, C-H-A-N-A .com. And she has been telling us about the exciting work that she does with clients. She is a member, as I am, of the American Herbalist Guild, which also you may want to join us. We are having a local American Herbalist Guild meeting on Long Island on July 12th. It's open to anyone. And Sarah has completed 500 clinical hours on homeopathic medicine with the Maya School of Homeopathy. So this is a very serious study. And Sarah is available to the community to learn about using herbs and homeopathic remedies for yourself and your children. And would you say that mainly, Sarah, that's your patient population is parents and their families?
Yes. I mean, I started with newborns, and as my newborns grew, I stayed with them, and then I was working with the mothers with their challenges, and then their husbands would come on board, and then their mother-in-laws would come on board. So I have a really nice family practice, and one of the really fascinating things is that besides the fact that I've been able to see babies grow into toddlers, into, you know, school-age children, into teenagers, I don't want to age myself, but it's really nice because I become close with the family, and I remember and know who they are and what their challenges are. And I'll remind them, oh, don't you remember 2 winters ago we also, you know, dealt with those chronic sinus infections. Let's look back in our charts and see what we did. And it's kind of going back to that family practice that I feel, unfortunately, is really being lost in America.
Well, has been lost, but I would say is coming back due to work like people like you and just in terms of the interest. I mean, when I started in this field, it was 1964.
Yeah.
And boy, it's actually grown quite a bit, although it is still, there's still a ways to go because there's so much resistance in the conventional medical community. But it sounds like you've had good work, luck working along with physicians.
I really try hard to. I can say honestly in the beginning of my practice, I was a little bit tougher, shall I say, and not as forgiving and understanding. But I also just recently taught at a medical school, and it was very fascinating. They were third-year pediatric residents. They had finished their 4 years of medical training. I was invited to teach breastfeeding, and I want you to I'm questioning you, how many classes do you think they got on breastfeeding in their 4 years of medical school and 3 years of pediatric internship?
Probably none.
None. So I was their absolute first class on breastfeeding, and they're graduating. They're done. And I walked away realizing that they just don't know. You know what I'm saying? They're just not familiar enough. So, you know, when we talk about breast infections, they can't even think outside the box on how to treat it. So, you know, as I've aged and dealt with a lot more pediatricians and obstetricians and surgeons, I tend to be a little more sympathetic and understand that they're just not familiar with it. And I think that their fear is knowing who to trust, who not to trust. And you asked me earlier why I joined AHG, and one of the reasons was I wanted to show that there are people that take their study very seriously. And that's what I want my doctor friends to understand, that, you know, any opportunity, I'm sitting at a lecture, I mean, you know, I do all the botanical webinars that I can, and I'm constantly upgrading my knowledge and reading clinical reports. And I think that doctors have to understand that's what a lot of alternative practitioners are all about.
That's true, and yeah, alternative, you know, would be alternative, let's say, to pharmaceutical drugs, but a word that I really love is traditional medicine, because what you're doing is actually traditional healing. The
right.
Herbal medicine is traditional. The pharmaceutical drugs are conventional or allopathic
right.
or modern,
right.
but they are not traditional. And I just love some of the articles you have on your website at sarahchana.com. For instance,
yeah.
you have a little blurb on one of my favorite herbs that anyone can grow in their yard, which is motherwort.
My
now,
favorite.
How, you too. Now, how would a plant get a name like that? That's where we start.
Yeah, I mean, you can tell me that history. I mean, I'm just so in love with the plant. I'm always surprised that that is not the number one American plant, and I still don't understand why it's not. I mean, it is probably my absolute favorite herb that I have in my practice.
And that's because you're dealing with mothering issues. And you know, when a plant gets a name like that, because
right.
the word wort, W-O-R-T, means plant in old
yes.
English. So if something's called motherwort, it means a plant that has been used throughout history traditionally for mother issues. And that's
yes.
why you're finding it so useful.
Love it. I mean, I do give it to men, too. We can definitely discuss that. There are men that need that mothering, that's for sure.
That's
but
true.
Mother wort is, we use it in our practice for that hormonal gloominess and sadness that seems to come out of the blue. Those days that everything seems to be perfect, everything's running fine, and all of a sudden you're feeling gloomy, you're feeling agitated, you feel like you're gonna, your mood's gonna flare up, and motherwort is an herb that you feel. I find that my clients feel it within 20 minutes of ingestion. I feel that they feel it working in their body. A lot of my clients will take it preventatively. My clients will take it before they menstruate, during the time they menstruate, when they're not menstruating. And it's an herb that I find that women and young girls use phenomenally well on their own. They know when they need it. They never abuse it. They stop it when they start to feel better. And it's just such a great herb to carry around in your purse.
Well, I'll give a shout out for older women like myself because,
yes,
boy, is motherwort wonderful for the entire menopausal,
yes,
scene. In fact, it actually has a specific calming action between 2 and 4 a.m., which is when many older women wake up with hot flashes and feelings of anxiety and worry. So,
yes,
what a great friend. Share,
yeah,
with me when you might use it for a man, because that's not something I have considered, and I like to learn new things too.
Well, you know, it's very interesting because I believe very much in the blood type diet. I can say that I didn't want to at first, and I'm really surprised that I find that when, and we're going to mothers and then we're going to go right back to men, that when women are breastfeeding and they have very, very colicky babies, that when they eat right for their blood type, the baby stopped crying. I mean, it was a phenomenon. It was one of my office managers that said I had to look into it, and it was not something that I was trained in. So now, why am I discussing that? Because my blood type B men really have hormonal issues. I find that they get grumpy and moody at the wrong times, right before business meetings. If their secretary does something wrong that's really not a big deal and all of a sudden they get very agitated, I find my blood type B men do very well with motherwort. It seems to balance their hormonal swings also. Isn't that interesting?
It is. It is.
Yeah.
And I'll have to give that further thought because, you know, certainly both men and women have hormonal swings, although,
yes,
men are not usually given that thought as often,
yes,
as women are, but it's certainly true.
There is. There's a lot of brain research going on right now, and when they do scans of the brain, they can see as the men age that the shape of the brain also changes, and we see that men get, you know, excessive estrogen when they start to lose their hair. They start to get those little pudges on their stomach. So they're having hormonal swings also, and I really find my men that get moody when they don't want to be moody do well with motherwort. Isn't that fascinating?
Yes, and I want to ask you something that's certainly controversial. I have my well-known thoughts about this, but I'd like to know, how do you support people in terms of vaccinations?
Oh, that's a topic that's so touchy, and I have so many pediatricians that do respect my work that I have to say honestly that I leave it up to the individual. I will say that I think some vaccines were a phenomenal discovery, and I think others are just something that pharmaceutical companies are making money on. So it's a very touchy subject.
Yes, it is. So if, let's say this then, if a mother does get her child vaccinated, is there anything you would help her with in terms of offsetting possible adverse effects?
Well, yes. I would advise getting the vaccines at a slower rate possibly than American doctors suggest. We can look at the Japanese that do not vaccinate. And again, things can change. Don't quote me exactly on this, but from my last research, they don't vaccinate children before age 2. And there are homeopathic remedies that we give. Ledum, which is for an injection we often give. We also give sometimes Thuja. That seems to be the most famous one. And there's a doctor you may really enjoy looking into. And I think that anybody that's interested in understanding homeopathy and vaccines need to learn or study the research of a doctor named Dr. Tinus Smith, T-I-N-U-S Smith, S-M-I-T-S. He is an MD, and he does research. I'm not sure if he's from Sweden or Denmark. I'm trying to look it up very quickly. He does research on vaccines, how they affect the immune system, and how homeopathy can counter difficult and challenging side effects from vaccines. And he is a doctor, and I follow his protocol a lot.
excellent, because that does, you know, I've used Thuja very often and other specific remedies that does seem to tone down any of those adverse immune system events.
I'm sorry to cut you off. Sometimes we give the homeopathic remedy of the vaccine, and it really works well to counter any side effects.
Yes, and I have done that myself, and I've actually been able to raise the titers measurably for those parents who don't wish to go ahead and get the vaccines. If you get a raised titer, that's actually considered legal tender.
Right.
So all kinds of interesting discussions about that topic.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You did mention food briefly. You mentioned the blood type diet.
Yes.
And is food always part of your recommendation in terms of creating a healthy, happy family?
Well, you know, the most important thing is to look at a family and see what their compliance is going to be. And one of the things is my clients do not walk out with 1,000 supplements and 1,000 herbs. I spend a lot of time hearing what their lifestyle is like, what their travel plans are like, you know, what the dynamics of the household are, and try to find the smallest and simplest protocol that I can give them. So, you know, it depends. When I have chronic illness with an adult or a child, we definitely look at the foods. If we have children that are basically healthy and just occasionally get sick, I really take it case by case. But of course, you know, whole food, the way it was created, is obviously the best way to eat it. And I give a lot of recipes in my office. I have a big, big cookbook in my office. And I will sit there and literally, because one thing I found is, as a practitioner, is if you tell someone to change their diet and you don't tell them how to replace it, it's really hard. So I give spelt cookie recipes and I give casserole recipes. So usually my clients leave with one or two recipes.
Well, thank you so much for being our guest today, Sarah. It was a really great conversation and very helpful to many of our listeners. And listeners, you can find Sarah Channa at her name, S-A-R-A-C-H-A-N-A, sarachana.com. And, of course, you can find us at naturalnurse.com. I'm Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, and Facebook, The Natural Nurse. So we're easy to find. And you can also visit the archives at Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, the natural, look under Natural Nurse, and you can find today's show and many of our past shows. And until next time, this is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.